strange readings this week, aren't they? Maccabees. I really struggle with Maccabees, bless them. When I was a student in Rome, we used to get a lot of pilgrims. And in those days, you didn't have to book in, you know, nowadays you have to book to get a group in. And then you get the official tour. So all the good bits are taken out of it. So all the stories we used to tell, the oral history, if you like, of the college, you don't get it anymore. You have the revised standard version where everyone behaves brilliantly and Ralph Sherwin doesn't draw a sword on the rector and threaten to run him through at the beginning of the college history. When I told the story last time I was there, the nun was horrified. And she said, "Why have you done that?" And I said, "Well, because that's what happened." And she went, "Oh, really?" And I said, "Yeah, and you live here. You should know that." But what we used to do, we used to take them upstairs in the church where the organ was. And then we'd turn the lights on and we'd take them around these frescoes. And the thing about the frescoes is they looked amazing until you really started looking at them. And you'd realise they're actually quite horrible. So we used to put them in front of this group of nuns. And they'd say, "What's this then?" You'd say, "Well, story about these nuns in the 8th century, and they're kind of a group of nuns who were martyred by the Vikings. And do you notice anything missing?" And of course, to stop themselves being ravished by the Vikings, they cut their own noses off. Right? So, which is true, this is true. So all the noses were in a little pile at the front of the fresco. Nobody, because you don't expect it. You just don't expect it. And everyone would go, that's disgusting. Unless you had a load of kids with you, and it was like, "Oh, that's brilliant, that is." But so, you know, Maccabees is a bit like that, where you expect, you know, you don't expect it. You don't expect the torture, the great reams and reams of torture. And the fact that you know, it went on and it happened. But you've got to laugh sometimes, because I don't know about you, but if I'm sticking my tongue out to have it ripped out, I'm not going to be able to say, "It was heaven, it gave me these limbs for the sake of the laws, I disdain them, for I have hoped to receive them again." You're not going to be able to do that, because you know, your tongue's out. But and that's me being flippant, and I apologise for that, but I have to do that, because I really do struggle with the whole brutality of Maccabees. And I understand it happened, and it's historical. But you might wonder why it's there, because it's one of those readings that we have, you know, during the weekdays, we get it every other year. We get a whole series of Maccabees. And it's not to do with, it's to do not with the seven brothers in the gospel. It's to do with the origins of resurrection. It was the Maccabean period of Jewish history where most people decided that they believed that there would be a resurrection from the dead. And they were influenced by that by their experience of other religions in the ancient Near East. But theologians would say, you know, revelation develops. And it is transformed by people's experience of God and new experiences of God. So Maccabees is a fertile period for the changing face of Judaism. So you go from the Sadducean position that there was no resurrection to the Pharisaical position that there was resurrection. And that's important because it gave them hope. Because the Sadducees basically didn't believe, and they didn't believe for two reasons. To give them the benefit of the doubt, you could say that they didn't believe for theological reasons, that in the law, it seems to indicate that that God will reward the just and will punish the wicked during this life. So that at the end of it all, you know, you go downstairs to Hades and there's a half-life. But by then, if you're a Sadducee, you've enjoyed the fruits of your righteousness. So that's given them a theological kind of tick. But the other thing about Sadducees was they were all rich. And therefore, there was a kind of an economic reason to believe what they believed. So it meant that they didn't really have to care in the same way for the poor as maybe the Pharisees would have done. Because their take on it would have been, "You're poor, therefore you're feckless, or you're a sinner, or you're lazy, or you're a migrant." You know, and that hasn't changed. The rich are still doing that. Got government still doing that, to be fair. apparently we've been invaded. I must have missed that one. But it's there, and it's the attitude of the rich to the poor, and it's wrong. And Jesus takes them up on it, really. Because it's a horrible question. I mean, it is a theological question in the sense of it's like, you know, when I was in seminary, we didn't argue about how many angels could dance on the head of a pin, because that question had been resolved, if you like, because when the scholastics came up with that one, there wasn't a number attached to it. It was one of those questions, it was a thought experiment, and it would be like, how, if you were trying to prove that millions of angels can dance on a pin, how would you do it? So you construct your argument in the following way. Well, the same thing's true here. It's a theological thought experiment in one sense. But what underlies it is an understanding of humanity, which is quite brutal. Because if you think about it, yes, in the law it says that if somebody dies, if a guy dies childless, for his name to, you know, the widow should be taken on by the brother. That is in, I think that's in Exodus somewhere. And so they say, well, okay, that's true. But then they have this poor woman being passed down like some kind of ragtag handbag through seven people. And even as a theological thought experiment, that's a pretty nasty way of looking at women. Because a woman at that point, she's just a thing, not a person. To put it, she's a receptacle. That's all she is. And that would have offended Jesus, because Jesus understood women in a way that a lot of men at that time did not. And so he kind of, and beyond that as well, is the idea that because he speaks with a strange accent and he's from Galilee, he must be stupid. And they really believe that. So this you've got to imagine this asked in a sarcastic way. So what Jesus does is he answers it, and he answers it in a way that indicates that that human beings and relationships with human beings are far more important than the Sadducees believe, and that carries on not just in this life, but in the life to come. And I think part of it is if you treat the person in your life, if we treat each other in a manner that recognises the divinity that is present in everyone, then that gets us ready to experience the next life. Because if you can see God in the person next to you, then you won't have a problem recognising God when you get upstairs. I mean, I often think, you know, and this is just me being whimsical, I suppose, but, you know, when everyone's got visions of the holy gates and everything else, and I often wonder if we get up there and there'll be somebody, you know, an old guy kind of doing the brushing by the gates, and we'll walk past him, and that'll be God the Father. And then some people will be able to say, oh, didn't realise you were doing the brushing, God, and God would say, oh, thanks for noticing. You know, and other people won't notice at all. They'll just kind of, but they might be left waiting outside a bit because they didn't see him. And I think the Sadducees are a little bit like that. They're so used to seeing the world in a way, in a certain way, that anything that doesn't fit with it, they're not interested in. And they will relentlessly make fun of people who believe differently. And again, I don't think that's changed either. But for us, as disciples of Jesus, what it encourages us to recognise is, you know, the divinity of the person sitting next to you, or behind you, or in front of you. Yeah, and you know, and it doesn't do any harm to look at the person next to you and see the divinity in them, or try and see the divinity in them. Looking at you, yeah. Still looking, still fine. But it's true. And if you can, then that's the point, isn't it? Because that's where the life is. You know, I don't know a lot. I mean, nobody knows anything about resurrection because only Jesus has done it, basically. But I truly believe that love is stronger than death. But the only thing I would be confident in terms of the I mean, I'm confident in the afterlife and I'm confident that God loves me. But the one thing I know deep down is that love conquers all. And if we've loved, that's all we're asked to do. That's it. Everything else is an extra, really. But if we haven't loved, then we're not going to see, are we? So that's the thing. The thing that Jesus tries to get us to do, and one of the things that the Sadducees are very guilty of, and a lot of theologians are guilty of it as well, is that we're trained in the West to live in our heads. That's how we see the world. That's why we've got COP27, because we don't see the world as an organism. We see the world as a commodity. We see people as commodities because we live in our heads. Jesus doesn't live in his head. Jesus lives in his heart and his gut. And he sees the world as it is. That is, as a work of art fashioned by God, which we've been given care of. Not to plunder it, but to look after it. And that includes people. I mean, don't forget, 96% of the planet does live in poverty. And at some point, that has got to change. We can't see people just as things. We have to see people as people. I mean, think of the rhetoric we've had over the last 2-3 months with the whole heating crisis, where, you know, difficult decisions have to be made is the fallback position. What people aren't seeing, or what government doesn't seem to see, and I think this is true of most politicians, to be fair, it's not just the Conservatives. The way we think about it is basically utilitarian. If somebody's not useful, if they have no useful function in society, they don't count. And that's not Christianity. Because how can you say that somebody created in the image and likeness of God, as a work of art of God, has no value? You can't. And that means you've got to be merciful and compassionate and loving. And if you're not, then don't wrap yourself in God's flag. And sadly, you know, we see that on both sides of the pond. So people who are kind of advocating stuff that Jesus must be weeping at, really. But we don't have to be like that. To end on a positive note, we can be disciples. We can see people and value them as they really are. And we can have the courage to love extravagantly and joyfully. With that word, my favourite new word is conviviality. I just think that's great. To be convivial. You know, to recognise that God is present in all of us. And to honour that and to celebrate it.